And let the poor Basilio die, Basilio whose poverty clipped the wings of his happiness, and brought him to the grave. And so saying, he seized the staff he had driven into the ground, and leaving one half of it fixed there, showed it to be a sheath that concealed a tolerably long rapier. And what may be called its hilt being planted in the ground, he swiftly, coolly, and deliberately threw himself upon it, and in an instant the bloody point and half the steel blade appeared at his back, the unhappy man falling to the earth bathed in his blood, and transfixed by his own weapon. His friends at once ran to his aid, filled with grief at his misery and sad fate, and Don Quixote, dismounting from Rocinante, hastened to support him, and took him in his arms, and found he had not yet ceased to breathe. They were about to draw out the rapier, but the priest who was standing by objected to its being withdrawn before he had confessed him, as the instant of its withdrawal would be that of his death. Basilio, however, reviving slightly, said in a weak voice, as though in pain, "If thou wouldst consent, cruel Quiteria, to give me thy hand as my bride in this last fatal moment, I might still hope that my rashness would find pardon, as by its means I attained the bliss of being thine." Hearing this, the priest bade him think of the welfare of his soul rather than of the cravings of the body, and in all earnestness implore God's pardon for his sins and for his rash resolve. To which Basilio replied that he was determined not to confess unless Quiteria first gave him her hand in marriage, for that happiness would compose his mind and give him courage to make his confession. Don Quixote, hearing the wounded man's entreaty, exclaimed aloud that what Basilio asked was just and reasonable, and moreover a request that might be easily complied with, and that it would be as much to Señor Camacho's honour to receive the Lady Quiteria as the widow of the brave Basilio, as if he received her direct from her father. "In this case," said he, "it will be only to say yes, and no consequences can follow the utterance of the word, for the nuptial couch of this marriage must be the grave." Camacho was listening to all this, perplexed and bewildered, and not knowing what to say or do. But so urgent were the entreaties of Basilio's friends, imploring him to allow Quiteria to give him her hand, so that his soul, quitting this life in despair, should not be lost, that they moved, nay, forced him, to say that if Quiteria were willing to give it, he was satisfied, as it was only putting off the fulfilment of his wishes for a moment. At once all assailed Quiteria, and pressed her, some with prayers and others with tears, and others with persuasive arguments, to give her hand to poor Basilio. But she, harder than marble and more unmoved than any statue, seemed unable or unwilling to utter a word, nor would she have given any reply had not the priest bade her decide quickly what she meant to do, as Basilio now had his soul at his teeth, and there was no time for hesitation. On this, the fair Quiteria, to all appearance distressed, grieved, and repentant, advanced without a word to where Basilio lay, his eyes already turned in his head, his breathing short and painful, murmuring the name of Quiteria between his teeth, and apparently about to die like a heathen and not like a Christian. Quiteria approached him, and kneeling, demanded his hand by signs, without speaking. Basilio opened his eyes, and gazing fixedly at her, said, "Oh, Quiteria, why hast thou turned compassionate at a moment when thy compassion will serve as a dagger to rob me of life? For I have not now the strength left either to bear the happiness thou givest me in accepting me as thine, or to suppress the pain that is rapidly drawing the dread shadow of death over my eyes. What I entreat of thee, O thou fatal star to me, is that the hand thou demandest of me and wouldst give me be not given out of complacence or to deceive me afresh, but that thou confess and declare that without any constraint upon thy will, thou givest it to me as to thy lawful husband. For it is not meet that thou shouldst trifle with me at such a moment as this, or have recourse to falsehoods with one who has dealt so truly by thee." While uttering these words he showed such weakness that the bystanders expected each return of faintness would take his life with it. Then Quiteria, overcome with modesty and shame, holding in her right hand the hand of Basilio, said, No force would bend my will. As freely, therefore, as it is possible for me to do so, I give thee the hand of a lawful wife, and take thine, if thou givest it to me, of thine own free will, untroubled and unaffected by the calamity thy hasty act has brought upon thee. Yes, I give it, said Basilio, not agitated or distracted, but with unclouded reason that heaven is pleased to grant me. Thus do I give myself to be thy husband. And I give myself to be thy wife, said Quiteria, whether thou livest many years, or they carry thee from my arms to the grave.
For one so badly wounded, observed Sancho at this point, this young man has a great deal to say. They should make him leave off billing and cooing and attend to his soul, for to my thinking he has it more on his tongue than at his teeth.
Basilio and Quiteria having thus joined hands, the priest, deeply moved and with tears in his eyes, pronounced a blessing upon them, and implored heaven to grant an easy passage to the soul of the newly wedded man, who, the instant he received the blessing, started nimbly to his feet, and with unparalleled effrontery pulled out the rapier that had been sheathed in his body. All the bystanders were astounded, and some, more simple than inquiring, began shouting, "A miracle! A miracle!" But Basilio replied, "No miracle, no miracle. Only a trick, a trick." The priest, perplexed and amazed, made haste to examine the wound with both hands, and found that the blade had passed not through Basilio's flesh and ribs, but through a hollow iron tube full of blood, which he had adroitly fixed at the place, the blood, as was afterwards ascertained, having been so prepared as not to congeal. In short, the priest and Camacho and most of those present saw they were tricked and made fools of. The bride showed no signs of displeasure at the deception. On the contrary, hearing them say that the marriage, being fraudulent, would not be valid, she said that she confirmed it afresh, whence they all concluded that the affair had been planned by agreement and understanding between the pair, whereat Camacho and his supporters were so mortified that they proceeded to revenge themselves by violence, and a great number of them, drawing their swords, attacked Basilio, in whose protection as many more swords were in an instant unsheathed, while Don Quixote, taking the lead on horseback, with his lance over his arm and well covered with his shield, made all give way before him. Sancho, who never found any pleasure or enjoyment in such doings, retreated to the wine jars from which he had taken his delectable skimmings, considering that, as a holy place, that spot would be respected.
"Hold, sirs, hold!" cried Don Quixote in a loud voice. "We have no right to take vengeance for wrongs that love may do to us. Remember, love and war are the same thing, and as in war it is allowable and common to make use of wiles and stratagems to overcome the enemy, so in the contests and rivalries of love the tricks and devices employed to attain the desired end are justifiable, provided they be not to the discredit or dishonour of the loved object. Quiteria belongs to Basilio, and Basilio to Quiteria by the just and beneficent disposal of heaven. Camacho is rich, and can purchase his pleasure when, where, and as it pleases him. Basilio has but this ewe lamb, and no one, however powerful he may be, shall take her from him. These two whom God hath joined man cannot separate, and he who attempts it must first pass the point of this lance." And so saying, he brandished it so stoutly and dexterously that he overawed all who did not know him. But so deep an impression had the rejection of Quiteria made on Camacho's mind, that it banished her at once from his thoughts. And so the counsels of the priest, who was a wise and kindly disposed man, prevailed with him, and by their means he and his partisans were pacified and tranquilized, and to prove it put up their swords again, inveighing against the pliancy of Quiteria rather than the craftiness of Basilio. Camacho maintaining that, if Quiteria as a maiden had such a love for Basilio, she would have loved him too as a married woman, and that he ought to thank heaven more for having taken her than for having given her. Camacho and those of his following, therefore, being consoled and pacified, those on Basilio's side were appeased, and the rich Camacho, to show that he felt no resentment for the trick and did not care about it, desired the festival to go on just as if he were married in reality. Neither Basilio, however, nor his bride, nor their followers, would take any part in it,
and they withdrew to Basilio's village. For the poor, if they are persons of virtue and good sense, have those who follow, honour, and uphold them, just as the rich have those who flatter and dance attendance on them. With them they carried Don Quixote, regarding him as a man of worth and a stout one. Sancho alone had a cloud on his soul, for he found himself debarred from waiting for Camacho's splendid feast and festival, which lasted until night, and thus dragged away he moodily followed his master, who accompanied Basilio's party, and left behind him the fleshpots of Egypt. Though in his heart he took them with him, and their now nearly finished skimmings that he carried in the bucket conjured up visions before his eyes of the glory and abundance of the good cheer he was losing. And so, vexed and dejected, though not hungry, without dismounting from Dapple, he followed in the footsteps of Rocinante. Chapter 22. Wherein is related the grand adventure of the cave of Montesinos in the heart of La Mancha, which the valiant Don Quixote brought to a happy termination. Many and great were the attentions shown to Don Quixote by the newly married couple, who felt themselves under an obligation to him for coming forward in defence of their cause, and they exalted his wisdom to the same level with his courage, rating him as a Cid in arms and a Cicero in eloquence. Worthy Sancho enjoyed himself for 3 days at the expense of the pair, from whom they learned that the sham wound was not a scheme arranged with the fair Quiteria, but a device of Basilio's, who counted on exactly the result they had seen. He confessed, it is true, that he had confided his idea to some of his friends, so that at the proper time they might aid him in his purpose and ensure the success of the deception. "That," said Don Quixote, "is not and ought not to be called deception which aims at virtuous ends." And the marriage of lovers he maintained to be a most excellent end, reminding them, however, that love has no greater enemy than hunger and constant want. For love is all gaiety, enjoyment, and happiness, especially when the lover is in the possession of the object of his love, and poverty and want are the declared enemies of all these, which he said to urge Señor Basilio to abandon the practice of those accomplishments he was skilled in, for though they brought him fame, they brought him no money, and apply himself to the acquisition of wealth by legitimate industry, which will never fail those who are prudent and preserving. The poor man who is a man of honour, if indeed a poor man can be a man of honour, has a jewel when he has a fair wife, and if she is taken from him, his honour is taken from him and slain. The fair woman who is a woman of honour, and whose husband is poor, deserves to be crowned with the laurels and crowns of victory and triumph. Beauty by itself attracts the desires of all who behold it, and the royal eagles and birds of towering flight stoop on it as a dainty lure. But if beauty be accompanied by want and penury, then the ravens and the kites and other birds of prey assail it, and she who stands firm against such attacks well deserves to be called the crown of her husband. "Remember, O prudent Basilio," added Don Quixote, "it was the opinion of a certain sage, I know not whom, that there was not more than one good woman in the whole world, and his advice was that each one should think and believe that this one good woman was his own wife, and in this way he would live happy. I myself am not married, nor, so far, has it ever entered my thoughts to be so. Nevertheless, I would venture to give advice to anyone who might ask it as to the mode in which he should seek a wife such as he would be content to marry. The first thing I would recommend him would be to look to good name rather than wealth, for a good woman does not win a good name merely by being good, but by letting it be seen that she is so. And open looseness and freedom do much more damage to a woman's honour than secret depravity. If you take a good woman into your house, it will be an easy matter to keep her good, and even to make her still better. But if you take a bad one, you will find it hard work to mend her, for it is no very easy matter to pass from one extreme to another. I do not say it is impossible, but I look upon it as difficult." Sancho, listening to all this, said to himself, "This master of mine, when I say something that has weight and substance, says I might take a pulpit in hand and go about the world preaching fine sermons. But I say of him that when he begins stringing maxims together and giving advice, not only might he take a pulpit in hand, but 2 on each finger, and go into the marketplaces to his heart's content. Devil take you for a knight-errant! What a lot of things you know! I used to think in my heart that the only thing he knew was what belonged to his chivalry. But there is nothing he won't have a finger in." Sancho muttered this somewhat aloud, and his master overheard him, and asked, "What art thou muttering there, Sancho?"
"I am not saying anything or muttering anything," said Sancho. "I was only saying to myself that I wish I had heard what your worship has said just now before I married. Perhaps I'd say now the ox that's loose licks himself well."
"Is thy Teresa so bad, then, Sancho?"
"She is not very bad," replied Sancho, "but she is not very good. At least, she is not as good as I could wish."
"Thou dost wrong, Sancho," said Don Quixote, "to speak ill of thy wife, for after all she is the mother of thy children."
"We are quits," returned Sancho, "for she speaks ill of me whenever she takes it into her head, especially when she is jealous, and Satan himself could not put up with her then."
In fine, they remained 3 days with the newly married couple, by whom they were entertained and treated like kings. Don Quixote begged the fencing student to find him a guide to show him the way to the cave of Montesinos, as he had a great desire to enter it and see with his own eyes if the wonderful tales that were told of it all over the country were true. The student said he would get him a cousin of his own, a famous scholar, and one very much given to reading books of chivalry, who would have great pleasure in conducting him to the mouth of the very cave, and would show him all the lakes of Ruidera, which were likewise famous all over La Mancha and even all over Spain. And he assured him he would find him entertaining, for he was a youth who could write books good enough to be printed and dedicated to princes. The cousin arrived at last, leading an ass in foal, with a pack-saddle covered with a parti-coloured carpet or sackcloth. Sancho saddled Rocinante, got Dapple ready, and stocked his saddle-bags, along with which went those of the cousin, likewise well filled. And so, commending themselves to God and bidding farewell to all, they set out, taking the road for the famous cave of Montesinos. On the way, Don Quixote asked the cousin of what sort and character his pursuits, avocations, and studies were, to which he replied that he was by profession a humanist, and that his pursuits and studies were making books for the press, all of great utility and no less entertainment to the nation. One was called The Book of Liveries, in which he described 703 liveries with their colours, mottoes, and ciphers, from which gentlemen of the court might pick and choose any they fancied for festivals and revels, without having to go a-begging for them from anyone, or puzzling their brains, as the saying is, to have them appropriate to their objects and purposes. "For," said he, "I give the jealous, the rejected, the forgotten, the absent, what will suit them and fit them without fail. I have another book, too, which I shall call Metamorphoses, or the Spanish Ovid, one of rare and original invention for imitating Ovid in burlesque style. I show in it who the Giralda of Seville and the Angel of the Magdalena were, what the sewer of Vesinguera at Cordova was, what the bulls of Guisando, the Sierra Morena, the Leganitos and Lavapiés fountains at Madrid, not forgetting those of Piojo, of the Caño Dorado, and of the Priora, and all with their allegories, metaphors, and changes, so that they are amusing, interesting, and instructive all at once. Another book I have, which I call the Supplement to Polydor Virgil, which treats of the invention of things, and is a work of great erudition and research, for I establish and elucidate elegantly some things of great importance, which Polydor omitted to mention. He forgot to tell us who was the first man in the world that had a cold in his head, and who was the first to try salivation for the French disease, but I give it accurately set forth and quote more than 25 authors in proof of it, so you may perceive. I have laboured to good purpose, and that the book will be of service to the whole world." Sancho, who had been very attentive to the cousin's words, said to him, "Tell me, Señor, and God give you luck in printing your books, can you tell me, for of course you know, as you know everything, who was the first man that scratched his head? For to my thinking it must have been our father Adam."
"So it must," replied the cousin, "for there is no doubt but Adam had a head and hair, and being the first man in the world he would have scratched himself sometimes."
"So I think," said Sancho. "But now tell me, who was the first tumbler in the world?"
"Really, brother," answered the cousin, "I could not at this moment say positively without having investigated it. I will look it up when I go back to where I have my books, and will satisfy you the next time we meet, for this will not be the last time."
"Look here, Señor," said Sancho, "don't give yourself any trouble about it, for I have just this minute hit upon what I asked you. The first tumbler in the world, you must know, was Lucifer, when they cast or pitched him out of heaven, for he came tumbling into the bottomless pit."
"You are right, friend," said the cousin, and said Don Quixote, "Sancho, that question and answer are not thine own. Thou hast heard them from someone else.
"'Hold your peace, Signor,' said Sancho. "'Faith, if I take to asking questions and answering, I'll go on from this till tomorrow morning. Hey, to ask foolish things and answer nonsense, I needn't go looking for help from my neighbours.'
"'Thou hast said more than thou art aware of, Sancho,' said Don Quixote. "'For there are some who weary themselves out in learning and proving things that, after they are known and proved, are not worth a farthing to the understanding or memory.'
In this and other pleasant conversation the day went by, and that night they put up at a small hamlet, whence it was not more than 2 leagues to the cave of Montesinos. So the cousin told Don Quixote, adding that if he was bent upon entering it, it would be requisite for him to provide himself with ropes, so that he might be tied and lowered into its depths. Don Quixote said that even if it reached to the bottomless pit, he meant to see where it went to. So they bought about 100 fathoms of rope, and next day at 2 in the afternoon, they arrived at the cave, the mouth of which is spacious and wide, but full of thorn and wild fig bushes, and brambles and briars, so thick and matted that they completely close it up and cover it over. On coming within sight of it, the cousin, Sancho, and Don Quixote dismounted, and the first two immediately tied the latter very firmly with the ropes, and as they were girding and swathing him, Sancho said to him, "Mind what you're about, master mine. Don't go burying yourself alive, or putting yourself where you'll be like a bottle put to cool in a well. It's no affair or business of your worship's to become the explorer of this, which must be worse than a Moorish dungeon."
"Tie me and hold thy peace," said Don Quixote, "for an emprise like this, friend Sancho, was reserved for me."
And said the guide, "I beg of you, Señor Don Quixote, to observe carefully and examine with 100 eyes everything that is within there. Perhaps there may be some things for me to put in my book of transformations."
"The drum is in hands that will know how to beat it well enough," said Sancho Panza.
When he had said this and finished the tying, which was not over the armour, but only over the doublet, Don Quixote observed,
"It was careless of us not to have provided ourselves with a small cattle-bell to be tied on the rope close to me, the sound of which would show that I was still descending and alive. But as that is out of the question now, in God's hand be it to guide me."
And forthwith he fell on his knees, and in a low voice offered up a prayer to heaven, imploring God to aid him and grant him success in this, to all appearance, perilous and untried adventure, and then exclaimed aloud,
"O mistress of my actions and movements, illustrious and peerless Dulcinea del Toboso! If so be the prayers and supplications of this fortunate lover can reach thy ears, by thy incomparable beauty I entreat thee to listen to them, for they but ask thee not to refuse me thy favour and protection now that I stand in such need of them. I am about to precipitate, to sink, to plunge myself into the abyss that is here before me, only to let the world know that while thou dost favour me there is no impossibility I will not attempt and accomplish."
With these words he approached the cavern, and perceived that it was impossible to let himself down or effect an entrance, except by sheer force or cleaving a passage. So drawing his sword he began to demolish and cut away the brambles at the mouth of the cave, at the noise of which a vast multitude of crows and choughs flew out of it so thick and so fast that they knocked Don Quixote down. And if he had been as much of a believer in augury as he was a Catholic Christian, he would have taken it as a bad omen, and declined to bury himself in such a place. He got up, however, and as there came no more crows or night-birds like the bats that flew out at the same time with the crows, the cousin and Sancho giving him rope, he lowered himself into the depths of the dread cavern. And as he entered it, Sancho sent his blessing after him, making 1,000 crosses over him, and saying,
"God and Our Lady of the Rocks in France, and the Trinity of Gaeta guide thee, flower and cream of knights errant. There thou goest, thou dare-devil of the earth, heart of steel, arm of brass. Once more, God guide thee and send thee back safe, sound, and unhurt to the light of this world thou art leaving to bury thyself in the darkness thou art seeking there."
And the cousin offered up almost the same prayers and supplications.
Don Quixote kept calling to them to give him rope and more rope, and they gave it out little by little, and by the time the calls which came out of the cave as out of a pipe ceased to be heard, they had let down 100 fathoms of rope. They were inclined to pull Don Quixote up again, as they could give him no more rope. However, they waited about 30 minutes, at the end of which time they began to gather in the rope again with great ease and without feeling any weight, which made them fancy Don Quixote was remaining below. And persuaded that it was so, Sancho wept bitterly, and hauled away in great haste in order to settle the question.
When, however, they had come to, as it seemed, rather more than 80 fathoms, they felt a weight, at which they were greatly delighted. And at last, at 10 fathoms more, they saw Don Quixote distinctly, and Sancho called out to him, saying, "Welcome back, señor, for we had begun to think you were going to stop there to found a family." But Don Quixote answered not a word. And drawing him out entirely, they perceived he had his eyes shut, and every appearance of being fast asleep. They stretched him on the ground and untied him, but still he did not awake. However, they rolled him back and forwards and shook and pulled him about, so that after some time he came to himself, stretching himself just as if he were waking from a deep and sound sleep. And looking about him, he said, "God forgive you, friends. Ye have taken me away from the sweetest and most delightful existence and spectacle that ever human being enjoyed or beheld. Now indeed do I know that all the pleasures of this life pass away like a shadow and a dream, or fade like the flower of the field. Oh, ill-fated Montesinos, oh sore-wounded Durandarte, oh unhappy Belerma, oh tearful Guadiana, and ye, oh hapless daughters of Ruidera, who show in your waves the tears that flowed from your beauteous eyes." The cousin and Sancho Panza listened with deep attention to the words of Don Quixote, who uttered them as though with immense pain he drew them up from his very bowels. They begged of him to explain himself, and tell them what he had seen in that hell down there.
"Hell, do you call it?" said Don Quixote. "Call it by no such name, for it does not deserve it, as ye shall soon see."
He then begged them to give him something to eat, as he was very hungry. They spread the cousin's sackcloth on the grass, and put the stores of the saddlebags into requisition, and all three, sitting down lovingly and sociably, they made a luncheon and a supper of it all in one. And when the sackcloth was removed, Don Quixote of La Mancha said,
"Let no one rise, and attend to me, my sons, both of you."
Chapter 23 Of the wonderful things the incomparable Don Quixote said he saw in the profound cave of Montesinos, the impossibility and magnitude of which caused this adventure to be deemed apocryphal. It was about 4 in the afternoon when the sun, veiled in clouds with subdued light and tempered beams, enabled Don Quixote to relate, without heat or inconvenience, what he had seen in the cave of Montesinos to his 2 illustrious hearers. And he began as follows.
"A matter of some 12 or 14 times a man's height down in this pit, on the right-hand side, there is a recess or space, roomy enough to contain a large cart with its mules. A little light reaches it through some chinks or crevices, communicating with it and open to the surface of the earth. This recess or space I perceived when I was already growing weary and disgusted at finding myself hanging suspended by the rope, travelling downwards into that dark region without any certainty or knowledge of where I was going. So I resolved to enter it and rest myself for a while. I called out, telling you not to let out more rope until I bade you, but you cannot have heard me. I then gathered in the rope you were sending me, and making a coil or pile of it, I seated myself upon it, ruminating and considering what I was to do to lower myself to the bottom, having no one to hold me up. And as I was thus deep in thought and perplexity, suddenly and without provocation a profound sleep fell upon me, and when I least expected it, I know not how, I awoke, and found myself in the midst of the most beautiful, delightful meadow that nature could produce, or the most lively human imagination conceive. I opened my eyes, I rubbed them, and found I was not asleep, but thoroughly awake. Nevertheless, I felt my head and breast to satisfy myself whether it was I myself who was there or some empty, delusive phantom. But touch, feeling, the collected thoughts that passed through my mind all convinced me that I was the same then and there that I am this moment. Next there presented itself to my sight a stately royal palace or castle, with walls that seemed built of clear, transparent crystal. And through 2 great doors that opened wide therein, I saw coming forth and advancing towards me a venerable old man, clad in a long gown of mulberry-coloured serge that trailed upon the ground. On his shoulders and breast he had a green satin collegiate hood, and covering his head a black Milanese bonnet, and his snow-white beard fell below his girdle.
He carried no arms whatever, nothing but a rosary of beads bigger than fair-sized filberts, each tenth bead being like a moderate ostrich egg. His bearing, his gait, his dignity and imposing presence held me spellbound and wondering. He approached me, and the first thing he did was to embrace me closely, and then he said to me, "For a long time now, O valiant knight Don Quixote of La Mancha, we who are here enchanted in these solitudes have been hoping to see thee, that thou mayest make known to the world what is shut up and concealed in this deep cave, called the Cave of Montesinos, which thou hast entered, an achievement reserved for thy invincible heart and stupendous courage alone to attempt. Come with me, illustrious sir, and I will show thee the marvels hidden within this transparent castle, whereof I am the steward and perpetual warden. For I am Montesinos himself, from whom the cave takes its name." The instant he told me he was Montesinos, I asked him if the story they told in the world above here was true, that he had taken out the heart of his great friend Durandarte from his breast with a little dagger, and carried it to the Lady Belerma, as his friend when at the point of death had commanded him. He said in reply that they spoke the truth in every respect except as to the dagger, for it was not a dagger, nor little, but a burnished poniard sharper than an awl. "That poniard must have been made by Ramon de Osses, the civilian," said Sancho.
"I do not know," said Don Quixote. "It could not have been made by that poniard-maker, however, because Ramon de Osses was a man of yesterday, and the affair of Roncesvalles, where this mishap occurred, was long ago. But the question is of no great importance, nor does it affect or make any alteration in the truth or substance of the story."
"That is true," said the cousin. "Continue, Señor Don Quixote, for I am listening to you with the greatest pleasure in the world."
"And with no less do I tell the tale," said Don Quixote.
"And so, to proceed. The venerable Montesinos led me into the Palace of Crystal, where, in a lower chamber, strangely cool and entirely of alabaster, was an elaborately wrought marble tomb, upon which I beheld, stretched at full length, a knight, not of bronze or marble or jasper as are seen on other tombs, but of actual flesh and bone. His right hand, which seemed to me somewhat hairy and sinewy, a sign of great strength in its owner, lay on the side of his heart. But before I could put any question to Montesinos, he, seeing me gazing at the tomb in amazement, said to me, 'This is my friend Durandarte, flower and mirror of the true lovers and valiant knights of his time. He is held enchanted here, as I myself and many others are, by that French enchanter Merlin, who they say was the devil's son. But my belief is not that he was the devil's son, but that he knew, as the saying is, a point more than the devil. How or why he enchanted us no one knows, but time will tell, and I suspect that time is not far off. What I marvel at is that I know it to be as sure as that it is now day, that Durandarte ended his life in my arms, and that, after his death, I took out his heart with my own hands. And indeed it must have weighed more than 2 pounds, for according to naturalists, he who has a large heart is more largely endowed with valour than he who has a small one. Then, as this is the case, and as the knight did really die, how comes it that he now moans and sighs from time to time, as if he were still alive?' As he said this, the wretched Durandarte cried out in a loud voice, 'O cousin Montesinos, 'twas my last request of thee, when my soul hath left the body, and that lying dead I be, with thy poniard or thy dagger cut the heart from out my breast, and bear it to Belerma. This was my last request.' On hearing which, the venerable Montesinos fell on his knees before the unhappy knight, and with tearful eyes exclaimed, 'Long since, Señor Durandarte, my beloved cousin, long since have I done what you bade me on that sad day when I lost you. I took out your heart as well as I could, not leaving an atom of it in your breast. I wiped it with a lace handkerchief, and I took the road to France with it, having first laid you in the bosom of the earth, with tears enough to wash and cleanse my hands of the blood that covered them after wandering among your bowels. And more by token, O cousin of my soul, at the first village I came to after leaving Roncesvalles, I sprinkled a little salt upon your heart to keep it sweet and bring it, if not fresh, at least pickled, into the presence of the Lady Belerma, whom, together with you, myself, Guadiana, your squire, the duenna Rudiera, and her 7 daughters and 2 nieces, and many more of your friends and acquaintances, the sage Merlin has been keeping enchanted here these many years. And although more than 500 have gone by, not one of us has died. Ruidera and her daughters and nieces alone are missing, and these, because of the tears they shed, Merlin, out of the compassion he seems to have felt for them, changed into so many lakes, which to this day in the world of the living and in the province of La Mancha are called the Lakes of Ruidera. The 7 daughters belong to the kings of Spain, and the 2 nieces to the knights of a very holy order called the Order of St. John. Guadiana, your squire, likewise bewailing your fate, was changed into a river of his own name. But when he came to the surface and beheld the sun of another heaven, so great was his grief at finding he was leaving you, that he plunged into the bowels of the earth. However, as he cannot help following his natural course, he from time to time comes forth and shows himself to the sun and the world. The lakes aforesaid send him their waters, and with these and others that come to him, he makes a grand and imposing entrance into Portugal. But for all that, go where he may, he shows his melancholy and sadness, and takes no pride in breeding dainty, choice fish, only coarse and tasteless sorts, very different from those of the golden tagus. All this that I tell you now, O cousin mine, I have told you many times before, and as you make no answer, I fear that either you believe me not, or do not hear me, whereat I feel God knows what grief. I have now news to give you, which, if it serves not to alleviate your sufferings, will not in any wise increase them. Know that you have here before you, open your eyes, and you will see, that great knight of whom the sage Merlin has prophesied such great things, that Don Quixote of La Mancha, I mean, who has again, and to better purpose than in past times, revived in these days knight-errantry long since forgotten, and by whose intervention and aid it may be we shall be disenchanted, for great deeds are reserved for great men. And if that may not be, said the wretched Durandarte in a low and feeble voice, if that may not be, then, my cousin, I say patience, and shuffle the cards. And turning over on his side, he relapsed into his former silence without uttering another word. And now there was heard a great outcry and lamentation, accompanied by deep sighs and bitter sobs. I looked round, and through the crystal wall I saw passing through another chamber a procession of 2 lines of fair damsels all clad in mourning, and with white turbans of Turkish fashion on their heads. Behind, in the rear of these, there came a lady, for so from her dignity she seemed to be, also clad in black, with a white veil so long and ample that it swept the ground. Her turban was twice as large as the largest of any of the others. Her eyebrows met, her nose was rather flat, her mouth was large but with ruddy lips, and her teeth, of which at times she allowed a glimpse, were seen to be sparse and ill-set, though as white as peeled almonds. She carried in her hands a fine cloth, and in it, as well as I could make out, a heart that had been mummified, so parched and dried was it. Montesinos told me that all those forming the procession were the attendants of Durandarte and Belerma, who were enchanted there with their master and mistress, and that the last, she who carried the heart in the cloth, was the Lady Belerma, who with her damsels 4 days in the week went in procession singing, or rather weeping, dirges over the body and miserable heart of his cousin, and that if she appeared to me somewhat ill-favoured, or not so beautiful as fame reported her, it was because of the bad nights and worst days that she passed in that enchantment, as I could see by the great dark circles round her eyes and her sickly complexion. Her sallowness and the rings round her eyes, said he, are not caused by the periodical ailment usual with women, for it is many months and even years since she has had any, but by the grief her own heart suffers because of that which she holds in her hand perpetually, and which recalls and brings back to her memory the sad fate of her lost lover. Were it not for this, hardly would the great Dulcinea del Toboso, so celebrated in all these parts, and even in the world, come up to her for beauty, grace, and gaiety.
"Hold hard," said I at this. "Tell your story as you ought, Señor Don Montesinos, for you know very well that all comparisons are odious,
and there is no occasion to compare one person with another. The peerless Dulcinea del Toboso is what she is, and the Lady Doña Belerma is what she is and has been, and that's enough. To which he made answer, "Forgive me, Señor Don Quixote. I own I was wrong and spoke unadvisedly in saying that the Lady Dulcinea could scarcely come up to the Lady Belerma. For it were enough for me to have learned, by what means I know not, that you are her knight, to make me bite my tongue out before I compared her to anything save heaven itself." After this apology, which the great Montesinos made me, my heart recovered itself from the shock I had received in hearing my lady compared with Belerma. "Still, I wonder," said Sancho, "that your worship did not get upon the old fellow and bruise every bone of him with kicks and pluck his beard until you didn't leave a hair in it." "Nay, Sancho, my friend," said Don Quixote, "it would not have been right in me to do that, for we are all bound to pay respect to the aged, even though they be not knights, but especially to those who are, and who are enchanted. I only know I gave him as good as he brought in the many other questions and answers we exchanged."
"I cannot understand, Señor Don Quixote," remarked the cousin here, "how it is that your worship, in such a short space of time as you have been below there, could have seen so many things, and said and answered so much."
"How long is it since I went down?" asked Don Quixote.
"Little better than an hour," replied Sancho.
"That cannot be," returned Don Quixote, "because night overtook me while I was there, and day came, and it was night again and day again 3 times, so that by my reckoning I have been 3 days in those remote regions beyond our ken."
"My master must be right," replied Sancho, "for as everything that has happened to him is by enchantment, maybe what seems to us an hour would seem 3 days and nights there."
"That's it," said Don Quixote.
"And did your worship eat anything all that time, señor?" asked the cousin.
"I never touched a morsel," answered Don Quixote, "nor did I feel hunger or think of it."
"And do the enchanted eat?" said the cousin.
"They neither eat," said Don Quixote, "nor are they subject to the greater excrements, though it is thought that their nails, beards, and hair grow."
"And do the enchanted sleep now, señor?" asked Sancho.
"Certainly not," replied Don Quixote. "At least, during those 3 days I was with them, not one of them closed an eye, nor did I either."
"The proverb, 'Tell me what company thou keepest, and I'll tell thee what thou art,' is to the point here," said Sancho. "Your worship keeps company with enchanted people that are always fasting and watching. What wonder is it, then, that you neither eat nor sleep while you are with them? But forgive me, señor, if I say that, of all this you have told us now, may God take me, I was just going to say the devil, if I believe a single particle."
"What?"
said the cousin. "Has Señor Don Quixote then been lying? Why, even if he wished it, he has not had time to imagine and put together such a host of lies."
"I don't believe my master lies," said Sancho. "If not, what dost thou believe?" asked Don Quixote.
"I believe," replied Sancho, "that this Merlin, or those enchanters who enchanted the whole crew your worship says you saw and discoursed with down there, stuffed your imagination or your mind with all this rigmarole you have been treating us to, and all that is still to come."
"All that might be, Sancho," replied Don Quixote, "but it is not so. For everything that I have told you I saw with my own eyes and touched with my own hands. But what will you say when I tell you now how, among the countless other marvellous things Montesinos showed me, of which at leisure and at the proper time I will give thee an account in the course of our journey, for they would not be all in place here, he showed me 3 country girls who went skipping and capering like goats over the pleasant fields there, and the instant I beheld them, I knew one to be the peerless Dulcinea del Toboso, and the other 2 those same country girls that were with her, and that we spoke to on the road from El Toboso. I asked Montesinos if he knew them, and he told me he did not, but he thought they must be some enchanted ladies of distinction, for it was only a few days before that they had made their appearance in those meadows. But I was not to be surprised at that, because there were a great many other ladies there of times past and present, enchanted in various strange shapes, and among them he had recognized Queen Guinevere and her dame Quintanona, she who poured out the wine for Lancelot when he came from Britain. When Sancho Panza heard his master say this, he was ready to take leave of his senses or die with laughter, for as he knew the real truth about the pretended enchantment of Dulcinea, in which he himself had been the enchanter and concoctor of all the evidence, He made up his mind at last that, beyond all doubt, his master was out of his wits and stark mad. So he said to him, "It was an evil hour, a worse season, and a sorrowful day when your worship, dear master mine, went down to the other world, and an unlucky moment when you met with Señor Montesinos, who has sent you back to us like this. You were well enough here above in your full senses, such as God had given you, delivering maxims and giving advice at every turn, and not as you are now, talking the greatest nonsense that can be imagined."
"As I know thee, Sancho," said Don Quixote, "I heed not thy words."
"Nor I your worship's," said Sancho, "whether you beat me or kill me for those I have spoken, and will speak if you don't correct and mend your own. But tell me, while we are still at peace, how or by what did you recognize the lady our mistress, and if you spoke to her, what did you say, and what did she answer?"
"I recognized her," said Don Quixote, "by her wearing the same garments she wore when thou didst point her out to me. I spoke to her, but she did not utter a word in reply. On the contrary, she turned her back on me and took to flight at such a pace that a crossbow bolt could not have overtaken her. I wished to follow her, and would have done so had not Montesinos recommended me not to take the trouble, as it would be useless, particularly as the time was drawing near when it would be necessary for me to quit the cavern. He told me, moreover, that in course of time he would let me know how he and Belerma and Durandarte and all who were there were to be disenchanted. But of all I saw and observed down there, what gave me the most pain was that, while Montesinos was speaking to me, one of the two companions of the hapless Dulcinea approached me without my having seen her coming, and with tears in her eyes said to me in a low, agitated voice, 'My lady Dulcinea del Toboso kisses your worship's hands, and entreats you to do her the favour of letting her know how you are. And being in great need, she also entreats your worship as earnestly as she can to be so good as to lend her half a dozen reals, or as much as you may have about you, on this new dimity petticoat that I have here, and she promises to repay them very speedily.'" I was amazed and taken aback by such a message, and turning to Señor Montesinos, I asked him, "Is it possible, Señor Montesinos, that persons of distinction under enchantment can be in need?" To which he replied, "Believe me, Señor Don Quixote, that which is called need is to be met with everywhere, and penetrates all quarters and reaches everyone, and does not spare even the enchanted. And as the lady Dulcinea del Toboso sends to beg those 6 reals, and the pledge is to all appearance a good one, there is nothing for it but to give them to her, for no doubt she must be in some great strait." "I will take no pledge of her," I replied, "nor yet can I give her what she asks, for all I have is 4 reals, which I gave. They were those which thou, Sancho, gavest me the other day to bestow in alms upon the poor I met along the road. And I said, 'Tell your mistress, my dear, that I am grieved to the heart because of her distress, and wish I was a Croesus to remedy them, and that I would have her know that I cannot be, and ought not be, in health while deprived of the happiness of seeing her and enjoying her discreet conversation, and that I implore her as earnestly as I can to allow herself to be seen and addressed by this her captive servant and forlorn knight. Tell her, too, that when she least expects it, she will hear it announced that I have made an oath and vow after the fashion of that which the Marquis of Mantua made to avenge his nephew Baldwin, when he found him at the point of death in the heart of the mountains, which was not to eat bread off a tablecloth, and other trifling matters, which he added, until he had avenged him. And I will make the same to take no rest and to roam the 7 regions of the earth more thoroughly than the Infante Don Pedro of Portugal ever roamed them, until I have disenchanted her."
"All that and more you owe, my lady," the damsel's answer came to me, and taking the 4 reals, instead of making me a curtsy, she cut a caper, springing 2 full yards into the air. "Oh, blessed God!" exclaimed Sancho aloud at this. "Is it possible that such things can be in the world, and that enchanters and enchantments can have such power in it as to have changed my master's right senses into a craze so full of absurdity? Oh, Señor, Señor, for God's sake, consider yourself, have a care for your honour, and give no credit to this silly stuff that has left you scant and short of wits."
"Thou talkest in this way because thou lovest me, Sancho," said Don Quixote, "and not being experienced in the things of the world, everything that has some difficulty about it seems to thee impossible. But time will pass, as I said before, and I will tell thee some of the things I saw down there which will make thee believe what I have related now, the truth of which admits of neither reply nor question."
Chapter 24. Wherein are related 1,000 trifling matters, as trivial as they are necessary to the right understanding of this great history. He who translated this great history from the original written by its first author, Side Hamete Benengeli, says that on coming to the chapter giving the adventures of the cave of Montesinos, he found written on the margin of it in Hamete's own hand these exact words. I cannot convince or persuade myself that everything that is written in the preceding chapter could have precisely happened to the valiant Don Quixote. And for this reason, that all the adventures that have occurred up to the present have been possible and probable. But as for this one of the cave, I see no way of accepting it as true, as it passes all reasonable bounds. For me to believe that Don Quixote could lie, he being the most truthful gentleman and the noblest knight of his time, is impossible. He would not have told a lie, though he was shot to death with arrows. On the other hand, I reflect that he related and told the story with all the circumstances detailed, and that he could not in so short a space have fabricated such a vast complication of absurdities. If, then, this adventure seems apocryphal, it is no fault of mine, and so, without affirming its falsehood or its truth, I write it down. Decide for thyself in thy wisdom, reader, for I am not bound, nor is it in my power to do more. Though certain it is, they say, that at the time of his death he retracted, and said he had invented it, thinking it matched and tallied with the adventures he had read of in his histories. And then he goes on to say, the cousin was amazed as well at Sancho's boldness as at the patience of his master, and concluded that the good temper the latter displayed arose from the happiness he felt at having seen his lady Dulcinea, even enchanted as she was, because otherwise the words and language Sancho had addressed to him deserved a thrashing, for indeed he seemed to him to have been rather impudent to his master, to whom he now observed, I, Señor Don Quixote of La Mancha, look upon the time I have spent in travelling with your worship as very well employed, for I have gained 4 things in the course of it. The first is that I have made your acquaintance, which I consider great good fortune. The second, that I have learned what the cave of Montesinos contains, together with the transformations of Guadiana and of the lakes of Ruidera, which will be of use to me for the Spanish Ovid that I have in hand. The third, to have discovered the antiquity of cards, that they were in use at least in the time of Charlemagne, as may be inferred from the words you say Durandarte uttered when, at the end of that long spell while Montesinos was talking to him, he woke up and said, "Patience, and shuffle the cards." This phrase and expression he could not have learned while he was enchanted, but only before he had become so in France, and in the time of the aforesaid Emperor Charlemagne. And this demonstration is just the thing for me for that other book I am writing, the Supplement to Polydore Virgil on the Invention of Antiquities. For I believe he never thought of inserting that of cards in his book, as I mean to do in mine, and it will be a matter of great importance, particularly when I can cite so grave and veracious an authority as Señor Durandarte. And the fourth thing is that I have ascertained the source of the river Guadiana, heretofore unknown to mankind.
You are right, said Don Quixote, but I should like to know if, by God's favour, they grant you a license to print those books of yours, which I doubt, to whom do you mean to dedicate them?
There are lords and grandees in Spain to whom they can be dedicated, said the cousin.
Not many, said Don Quixote, not that they are unworthy of it, but because they do not care to accept books and incur the obligation of making the return that seems due to the author's labour and courtesy. One prince I know who makes up for all the rest, and more. How much more, if I ventured to say, perhaps I should stir up envy in many a noble breast. But let this stand over for some more convenient time, and let us go and look for some place to shelter ourselves in tonight.
Not far from this, said the cousin, there is a hermitage where there lives a hermit, who they say was a soldier, and who has the reputation of being a good Christian and a very intelligent and charitable man. Close to the hermitage he has a small house, which he built at his own cost, but though small it is large enough for the reception of guests. "Has this hermit any hens, do you think?" asked Sancho.
"Few hermits are without them," said Don Quixote, "for those we see nowadays are not like the hermits of the Egyptian deserts, who were clad in palm leaves and lived on the roots of the earth. But do not think by praising these I am disparaging the others. All I mean to say is that the penances of those of the present day do not come up to the asceticism and austerity of former times. But it does not follow from this that they are not all worthy. At least, I think them so. And at the worst, the hypocrite who pretends to be good does less harm than the open sinner."
At this point they saw approaching the spot where they stood a man on foot, proceeding at a rapid pace, and beating a mule loaded with lances and halberds. When he came up to them, he saluted them and passed on without stopping. Don Quixote called to him,
"Stay, good fellow, you seem to be making more haste than suits that mule."
"I cannot stop, señor," answered the man, "for the arms you see I carry here are to be used tomorrow, so I must not delay. God be with you. But if you want to know what I am carrying them for, I mean to lodge tonight at the inn that is beyond the hermitage, and if you be going the same road you will find me there, and I will tell you some curious things. Once more, God be with you."
And he urged on his mule at such a pace that Don Quixote had no time to ask him what these curious things were that he meant to tell them. And as he was somewhat inquisitive and always tortured by his anxiety to learn something new, he decided to set out at once, and go and pass the night at the inn instead of stopping at the hermitage, where the cousin would have had them halt. Accordingly, they mounted and all three took the direct route for the inn, which they reached a little before nightfall. On the road, the cousin proposed they should go up to the hermitage to drink a sup. The instant Sancho heard this, he steered his Dapple towards it, and Don Quixote and the cousin did the same. But it seems Sancho's bad luck so ordered it that the hermit was not at home, for so a sub-hermit they found in the hermitage told them. They called for some of the best. She replied that her master had none, but that if they liked cheap water, she would give it with great pleasure. "If I found any in water," said Sancho, "there are wells along the road where I could have had enough of it. Ah, Camacho's wedding and plentiful house of Don Diego, how often do I miss you!" Leaving the hermitage, they pushed on towards the inn, and a little farther they came upon a youth who was pacing along in front of them at no great speed, so that they overtook him. He carried a sword over his shoulder, and slung on it a budget or bundle of his clothes, apparently, probably his breeches or pantaloons, and his cloak and a shirt or two, for he had on a short jacket of velvet with a gloss like satin on it in places, and his shirt out. His stockings were of silk, and his shoes square-toed as they wear them at court. His age might have been 18 or 19. He was of a merry countenance, and to all appearance of an active habit, and he went along singing seguidillas to beguile the wearisomeness of the road. As they came up with him, he was just finishing one, which the cousin got by heart, and they say ran thus, "I'm off to the wars for the want of pence. Oh, had I but money, I'd show more sense." The first to address him was Don Quixote, who said, "You travel very airily, Sir Gallant. Whither bound, may we ask, if it is your pleasure to tell us?" To which the youth replied, "The heat and my poverty are the reason of my travelling so airily, and it is to the wars that I am bound." "How poverty?" asked Don Quixote. "The heat, one can understand." "Señor," replied the youth, "in this bundle I carry velvet pantaloons to match this jacket. If I wear them out on the road, I shall not be able to make a decent appearance in them in the city, and I have not the wherewithal to buy others. And so for this reason, as well as to keep myself cool, I am making my way in this fashion to overtake some companies of infantry that are not 12 leagues off, in which I shall enlist. And there will be no want of baggage trains to travel with after that to the place of embarkation, which they say will be Cartagena. I would rather have the king for a master and serve him in the wars than serve a court pauper." "And do you have an appointment or a commission now?" asked the cousin. "If I had been in the service of some grandee of Spain or personage of distinction," replied the youth, "I should have been safe to get it, for that is the advantage of serving good masters, that out of the servants' hall men come to be ancients or captains or get a good pension. But I, to my misfortune, always served place-hunters and adventurers, whose keep and wages were so miserable and scanty that half went in paying for the starching of one's collars. It would be a miracle indeed if a page volunteer ever got anything like a reasonable station." "And tell me, for heaven's sake," asked Don Quixote, "is it possible, my friend, that all the time you served you never got any livery?" "They gave me 2, replied the page, "but just as when one quits a religious community before making profession they strip him of the dress of the order and give him back his own clothes, so did my masters return me mine. For as soon as the business on which they came to court was finished, they went home and took back the liveries they had given merely for show."
"What spilocheria, as an Italian would say," said Don Quixote. "But for all that, consider yourself happy in having left court with as worthy an object as you have, for there is nothing on earth more honourable or profitable than serving, first of all, God, and then one's king and natural lord, particularly in the profession of arms, by which,
if not more wealth, at least more honour is to be won than by letters, as I have said many a time. For though letters may have founded more great houses than arms, still those founded by arms have I know not what superiority over those founded by